never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Up next is Madison Bookbeat. Well, actually, you're going to hear the BBC headlines, then Madison Bookbeat. This week, host David Ahrens is talking with Tom Moskaller and Michael Williamson, co-authors of the book Bending Granite. Stay tuned.
I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. Large groups of people are gathering in the Mexican town of Mazatlan, where a total solar eclipse is due to start in the next few minutes. The eclipse will move on to the United States and finish in Canada. The moon will perfectly block the sun and the sky will go pitch dark for 4 minutes. An estimated 31 million people will be in the path of the eclipse. Our correspondent, Emma Vardy, is at an event in Dallas to see the phenomenon.
It's a celestial party across North America. From Niagara Falls down to the west coast of Mexico, people have been travelling from all over the world to witness the spectacle, and they're hoping for clear skies. Total solar eclipses happen somewhere on the planet around once every 18 months, but this one is particularly rare because millions of people will be in the path of totality as it passes across North America. Scientists at NASA will be watching today's eclipse closely. The space agency will be sending rockets into the path of darkness to study the outer atmosphere of the sun, known as its corona.
Donald Trump has said abortion rights should be decided by individual US states and appearing to resist pressure from conservative Republicans for an outright ban. In a statement to clarify his position, the Republican presidential candidate claimed credit for a Supreme Court decision 2 years ago ending the federal right to abortion, but said he supported certain exceptions. From Washington, here's Gary O'Donoghue.
At one time, Donald Trump said women who got an abortion should be punished, but in recent months, the former president has been equivocating over his position on a federal abortion ban. He's flirted with backing a nationwide limit of 15 or 16 weeks at times, and he's gone back and forth on what kinds of exceptions there should be to any laws. But now, with the presidential primary over and the general election looming, the Republican nominee has decided that taking the hardest of hardline stances risks galvanizing Democrats to turn out and vote.
The Israeli defense minister has indicated the time might be right to do a hostage deal with Hamas. Yoav Gallant was speaking as ceasefire talks continued in Cairo. Our correspondent Sebastian Usher sent this report from Jerusalem.
In an address to army recruits, Mr. Gallant said that he believed that Israel was at an opportune moment to do a deal with Hamas. The Israeli defense minister was speaking a day after Israel announced that it had pulled out all its forces from southern Gaza, leaving just one brigade in the entire territory for now. In Israel, there have been huge protests demanding that the government do whatever is necessary to save the remaining hostages. And in Cairo, the mood around the latest indirect talks between Israel and Hamas has been increasingly positive.
World News from the BBC. A study of hundreds of patients who'd been seriously ill with long COVID suggests some people's immune system remains overactive long after the initial infection has cleared. Those with the condition have evidence of inflammation in their blood, which might provide clues for their treatment. The study found that the presence of certain proteins increased the risk of symptoms such as fatigue. Russia's ambassador to the United Nations nuclear watchdog says his country has called an emergency meeting to discuss what he said were Ukrainian attacks on the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The facility, which Russia has occupied, is near to the front line of fighting, and both sides regularly accuse each other of shelling it. Reports from Mali say more than 100 people have died in an extreme heat wave, which has seen temperatures soar to more than 45 degrees Celsius over the past 4 days. The BBC's Makuochi Okafor has more details.
One of the largest hospitals in Bamako, Gabriel Touré University Hospital, says that the most affected are people over 60 years and with chronic illnesses. Dr. Boubacar Niari, the Deputy Secretary General for Malian Doctors Union, told the BBC that they are deeply concerned that dozens of people have died due to the heat wave, and the government is looking to find solutions to make sure everyone will be protected if the temperature rises again. The country's health ministry issued a warning advising people to stay hydrated, avoid intense activities, and stay indoors from midday to evening.
The Supreme Court in India has overturned an order that had imposed a blanket ban on overhead power lines in large areas of Rajasthan and Gujarat because critically endangered birds kept flying into them. The original ruling 5 years ago was intended to protect the great Indian bustard, but it also prevented the building of solar panels. The court said this threatened India's climate change targets. BBC News.
Are you passionate about community music and local voices? I'm Jay Davis, and I'm thrilled to share an exciting opportunity with you.
I'm Tom Davis, a proud member of the programming committee at WORT. We're the heartbeat of Madison, shaping the airwaves with diverse, engaging, and community-driven content. But to keep the beats flowing, we need your help.
Since you're listening to WORT right now, you may be aware of this, but this is more than just a radio station. It's a platform for local expression, a hub for artists, and a stage for community voices. Join our programming committee and become a driving force behind what goes on our airwaves.
Whether you're into music, news, culture, or something entirely unique, we want your voice in the mix.
Visit our website at wortfm.org/programming-committee, or you can email me directly with j.davis@wortfm.org, and we can start the conversation.
WORT, where your voice matters.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Madison Bookbeat. I'm your host, David Ahrens, and today, as you watch the lights fade, you can listen to this program about how we and you can help make organizations improve. We've all had experiences as part of organizations that don't do what you think they should do, that they're inefficient, that they are at times or always ineffective. But the question is, can that be changed? Are there methods, are there strategies that are evidence-based that can make that change? Or does it take some charismatic leader that are vanishingly rare to come in and do that thing which changes everybody? So we have as our guest today the authors and editors of a collection of essays on organizational improvement. And they wrote a book called Bending Granite, 30 True Stories About Leading Change. These stories are, as we'll get into it, mostly about organizations that are in or around Madison. So let me introduce you to them. First, we have Michael Williamson. And Michael has led many complex public organizations, including a stint in the city of Madison. Were you a deputy mayor?
I was chief of staff.
Chief of staff to?
For Mayor Joe Sensenbrenner.
Joe Sensenbrenner, great. Worked at UNC or North Carolina State?
I was at the University of North Carolina, right, as an adjunct faculty member.
Okay, and then for the state, you worked at ETF, is that right?
I actually ran the investment board.
Oh, okay.
Which invests the money for ETF.
Uh-huh, okay. This is the money you get. So our pensions, we could thank you, Michael.
Yep. Well, I eat my own cook, and I'm retired from that system, too.
Okay. So he now serves on the board of many nonprofits, where, again, he, as it says in the book, he attempts to create order out of chaos, and good luck with that. Then we also have Tom Mosscaller, who I think nicely the book says is a change agent by nature and a leader by nurture. And we'll get into that too, Tom. And Tom's led quality improvement programs, again, in the city of Madison, but throughout the country. Let's talk about what this quality improvement thing is. Is the notion that things don't just happen, but things that there's an intentional purpose to these things. So what is the what's called QI, or quality improvement?
So that's a great question, David. And I think the important thing is to understand that QI, quality improvement, or some people call it total quality management, or you see it today as Lean or Lean Six Sigma or other kind of titles for this effort, but they're really about a systematic approach to change and how to do that in a way where change is more than just change, but it's also improvement. Because we always say, you know, not all change is improvement in our lives. And so having an approach that makes sense is as important and timeless as history. Mm-hmm. People were doing this thousands of years ago and probably had some intentional approaches they used. We just happened to hit a period in which that became a real opportunity in our region of Wisconsin to make a difference. And it moved across the globe.
Mm-hmm. Tom, Mike, do you have anything to...
Yeah, the roots of the more current version and the version that we worked with came out of the statistical work that was done in the United States, got transported to Japan, and got developed there. And as Americans in the 70s, we began to see products, in Japanese products, that were no longer junk, but were actually high quality, whether that be cameras, computers, golf clubs, fishing rods and reels. And the question became
and some
over
cars
here.
Were...
And cars. You know, they used to be little 10 cars, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden they became high performing, highly desirable. People over here began asking the question, well, what caused that? Mm-hmm. And turns out it was American by the name of W. Edwards Deming, went over there and after the war worked with their industrialists and began to perfect these techniques. And they became, what happened was a report on the news that said, if Japan can, why can't we? And the assumption was, well, they work all the time. They don't have family life. The reality was there were simple steps and processes that had been developed. And those became on the American scene. And the Madison community was in the forefront of taking those, whether that be in governmental organizations or hospitals or private sector organizations. And this book is a compilation of their stories.
Yes. I mean, I think you raise a good point about the statistical issue here, statistical methods. Probably most folks who are listening to this program, and maybe this is just conjecture here, that have been through a situation where someone came in and, you know, did so-called strategic planning and people talked about how they felt about this and that, and then that ended. But that this is not a process, though it may include it in some way, of talking about how people feel about their work, but it's something that has really a quantitative and statistical basis in most cases. And in fact, one of the leaders in this area, or two of them, were statistics professors. How have you had cases or experiences where that came into play?
So, David, one thing that is really fundamental to this, I think, is an understanding that there was an organization here called the Joyner and Associates, mm-hmm. that had a strong relationship with the Japanese and helped people went over there and helped them with that work with Dr. Deming, and happened to be based here. And Brian was a statistician here at the UW, along with a real robust statistician cadre here at the UW. But they were always clear. It wasn't just statistics. It wasn't just about the data.
Widget counting.
I mean, it's important because we wanted to be data-based in what we did, right? Not just arbitrary and capricious. But it was also about building strong teams within the culture of an organization. And that, to me, was always, given my background, the most important thing. If you couldn't create a culture in which this could flourish, you're not going to get the kind of data you need because people ain't going to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So the importance of teamwork, being data-based, and customer focus. Start with understanding where the customer is, in this case, the taxpayer in our city, and how we best serve them as opposed to what the hierarchy perceives as the right way of delivery of service.
Let's talk a bit about, you used the C word, culture, and a number of people have sort of an epigram in their studies of culture eats strategy for breakfast. What's your take on that, Michael?
Well, I've worked in a number of different organizations, and you see people try to implement strategy without understanding the culture and being where the people, where the employees are in the organization. You know, we've organized this book around three major categories: mm-hmm. purpose, people, and process. And the people component of that deals with the culture. And it's been my experience that people in the organization understand what the needs are. They understand how the work gets done. The leadership needs to stop and listen to them and get feedback from them. And one of the major tenets of this approach was getting those frontline employees involved. And once that happened, they began to dissect the processes. They gathered the data, did the statistical analysis on it, and came up with solutions that leadership never would have really thought of. And that's the power of it, is using those employees to bring improvement into the organization.
So this is a pretty lengthy, deep process when you're going into, as you say, bringing the employees into the process and really having them become the change agents that the leadership could not or did not do, because that would be imposed from the top. So you're organizing and educating people to do it from the bottom. And that takes time. Do you sometimes get hung up on, do people get hung up on, we're having another meeting, we're having a...
Well, I think one of the things we've learned is the importance of early wins, right? So finding some things you can do that can really make a difference. Mm-hmm. And Michael's story in the book is about one of our first activities in the city mm-hmm. to actually deploy this, where we had some pretty skeptical people, mm-hmm. right, who were anxious about this.
Let's talk about it. It's a great story, and I think certainly Madison listeners would be interested in it. Go ahead. Have you, one or both, were you both doing it, or... Did you both do it? Or
we were both involved in the work in the city. In fact, Tom was hired as our quality improvement specialist to come in and work on the process. But early on, we used this team from the UW. We had a challenging issue in the city, and that was vehicles were taking way too long to get repaired. So if you were the police chief and you needed squad cars and they were down at the First Street garage, you couldn't deliver officers to where they were needed. If you were the parks director, it was rainy season in the summer, and your mowers were broken down and down at the garage, and you couldn't keep up, people started complaining about the condition of the parks. You know, one of the things in my story I say is, for every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's almost always wrong. And people in the city jump to, you know, quick solutions. It's the mechanics. They're union mechanics. They must not be working hard enough. The private sector can do it better, so let's contract out to them. Mm-hmm. We need to give them more. We need to lay off some of the mechanics, and the ones that are left will work harder. Well, we came in, we applied these techniques, and what we found was it was taking 9.5 days to repair a vehicle, which is way too long to get it back on the streets. And as we studied the process, we realized part of it was purchasing parts, and it took 28 steps to buy parts, and it took way too long. We got the employees involved in that process. They gathered the data. They realized we simplified the process, and rather than adding more mechanics, we were able to save $750,000, and we cut the repair time down to 2 days, so 48 hours. So it had tremendous success. We did not have to add more staff. We did not have to lay off people. But the power of it was we got the employees involved, mm-hmm. and that made all the difference. And that, as Tom was saying, was an early success that helped us build momentum.
And what was the employee involvement?
Yeah, there's two things I want to say about this, David, yeah. Going back to your original level of trust, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because for years, somebody else has told them what they do, and they bite their lip and grumble and just, you know, do it. And when we came down and mentioned the fact that we'd like to improve that process for buying parts, the first thing the union leader said is, why don't we just start by you cleaning the windows in this place so we can see inside? Mm-hmm. So when we look inside of an engine or something and get better light bulbs down here so we can look inside the vehicles, and you do that first. So mm-hmm. they were testing us on whether or not we would turn around those kind of small improvements on our behalf mm-hmm. before they would actually step up and do the kind of deep data collection it was going to take and truth-telling. But once we did that little improvement, right, and got those windows cleared and better lighting in this place, they were on board. And
you were their allies.
We mm-hmm. you know, they mm-hmm. were still cautious, mm-hmm. but they were willing to sit down at the table with us. And mm-hmm. we began using a very systematic approach to problem solving. We call it the 7-step problem solving process. Break out what the pieces of the problem are. Talk to the customers. I won't go through all that now, but mm-hmm. it was, you know, it was so we flow charted the darn thing, you know, using Post-its. Mm-hmm. Where does it start? Car comes into the motor equipment. Then what happens? Well, as Michael said, you know, 28 steps. My God, they never looked at it as a system. They just saw their piece, right? And all of a sudden they're looking up and saying, my God, look what's going on here. And then we started saying, why do we do this? Why do we do that? Why do we do that? Well, back 5 years ago, somebody did something wrong and, you know, somebody decided to put another check and sign, what we call, you know, yeah. check and sign. Yeah. And it just became more and more bureaucratic.
Did that catch on to other departments? So you had this, not a fireworks, incredible, you know, revolution here, though it was important for that department, but did that become part of the movement?
Well, I think the bell curve is in effect here. Those of you who remember some of your statistical studies, there are people in the front of the curve that are the leaders. We had people in the city that embraced it. There are people at the back end of the curve that said, this makes no sense at all. We're never going to do it. And then you had a lot of people in the middle. Mm-hmm. And those were people who said, well, you convince me. Show me that this works. It's worth my time. And slowly over time, we did that. Mm-hmm. And we built, in fact, there were a number of city supervisors and leaders who came to the Board of Estimates and said to them, we want you to put money in the budget to support this effort. It wasn't the mayor saying that we wanted. The mayor put it in there. But it was the people who had seen the results that came forth. And that's the power of this technique. And I just want to say, you know, we're talking about this in terms of historical terms, but these concepts that's in this book are still relevant in the organizations today. Mm-hmm. And people can get tips and shortcuts so that they don't have to develop the scar tissue that we did going through this and working. But it could be in their church organizations, could be in their community school organization, could be in their employment. Wherever they are, what kind of organization, these concepts still work today.
So let me give a plug here to, again, the book and a lot of the activity around quality improvement in this area comes through a certain organization. Is that right?
McKim.
Mm-hmm. You'd want to tell us about it?
Yeah, Madison Area Quality Improvement Network. And that really became kind of the catalyst for bringing all of us together and giving people a sense that we were part of something bigger. So in the city, I know for me and Michael and others, you know, it can get damn lonely when you're trying to create change mm-hmm. alone inside of 3,000 member organization. But by being part of that with American Family Insurance and, you know, you
hospitals
pick it. Hospitals, mm-hmm. educational environment. Mm-hmm. We, you know, MATC at that time, we had the taxi cab company, Union Cab. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, really in the water. Mm-hmm. And that just lifted a lot of boats. And we became nationally and globally seen as an amazing place. I've had people go to Japan, talk to the Japanese, and they say, So where would you go to really learn, be immersed in this? And they send them to us here in Madison because we had created all across the culture in our city of improvement, of emphasizing that kind of work.
Is it still going on?
McKinn is no longer in existence, but there are groups of people who are still meeting and doing this kind of work in various ways.
And one of the piece of network or locus of this is, I saw in your book, bendinggranite.com, and there people can find other people and listen to podcasts and additional kinds of case studies or just insights about how organizations work and particularly how we can help them change.
Yeah, we have tried to continue to make this a living thing through the website, bendinggranite.com. People can go there, they can see the podcast, they can listen to those, they can get information and hopefully get connected to other people. And there's also a quality organization in the state of Wisconsin now, too. I can't remember exactly what the formal name of it is. Do you?
Wisconsin Performance Excellence is, I think, what it's called, okay. Michael.
So you can certainly Google that, go online and look for that. And they hold workshops. They still have networking groups. So that's kind of the successor to the McKinn Group.
One of the sort of the knocks on QI movement process, whatever, is this concept, and I'm not saying that's about you guys, but, you know, McKinsey and so on, is the Lone Ranger who comes in and gets the job done and whips everybody into shape and leaves and then is gone for the aftershocks. I was reading this new biography of Martin Luther King, and that was really the rap on him. Was he was very unpopular in much of the civil rights movement because he would come in with his aides and his media following and come into a community and do an action and create a lot of change and then go on to the next community. But it was the community that he left that then suffered the aftershocks of that. So what's your take on that? How do you respond to that?
So David, when I came to the city to do this work, thanks to Michael and others who were setting the platform for the possibility of doing this at that time to get it rolling. I'd been a community organizer all my adult life, from the time I got back from the military until I joined the city at 40 years old. I was a community organizer in inner city Chicago, Philadelphia, and other places, organizing people. So I came out of much more of a cultural appreciation of building organizational power. Mm-hmm. I had to learn, and we were all learning, how to actually apply the process improvement methodology in an effective way. And in the city, we really worked to really counter what you're talking about, which is this, and I think there were people who would think that someone was going to come with a suitcase and fix the parts department problem down in Motor Equipment. But we didn't work that way. We came from the bottom up, got the people directly involved, and built a culture all across the organization where frontline people felt valued and empowered, as opposed to somebody riding in and riding out of town as answer man.
You know, there's sort of two, among the many different kind of ways to categorize this. Another way is not someone who comes from the outside, and I think this is probably the most difficult thing, is to be the change agent from within, someone who's potentially part of that culture and is just too integral to the situation. And one of the key people who, I guess the first chapter of it is David Cooper, who was the police chief in Madison, I guess, over the 70s, for the most part.
70s, 80s, early 90s.
Oh, really? It was okay. So for 20 years, and was a significant change agent and writes about some of this. And I saw that on the Bending Granite. Did you interview him recently, Tom? So you want to talk a bit about how he was different, really. I mean, he's sort of a different kind of character in the book in that he's the insider, not only just the insider, but he's the top dog. And how do you make changes that it's not someone that's coming from the bottom?
It's really nice when you go into an organization, and I've gone into a number of these in my life, to have a leader who is open, right? They don't have to necessarily embrace what we were proposing, but they got to be open to change. And David was clearly someone at that time who was actually in the beginning a little resistant to this because he was concerned that this was not going to really going to add value to what he was trying to do with a police department that he was trying to transform for what we call traditionally a law enforcement agency to what he wanted to see, which was much more peacekeeping emphasis, right? I mean, that's a major shift, right? But he went to one of the workshops Deming did, and he was going to get up and leave the darn thing. And Deming said, the most important thing is that your employees have joy in what they do. And David sat back down and listened and, you know, approached this then as one of the major leaders that Mike was referencing earlier in the city who championed our quality efforts.
So what were some of the things that he did, Michael, that were outstanding that might not have occurred had he not been sort of became a proponent and a user of this process?
Well, he worked to build teamwork and bring joy. So he would ask people on the department to give input. So you had officers who were assigned to actually work on buying the next squad car. And it was based upon what are the officers' needs in the car. In other words, they're the ones driving it. They're using it. But nobody ever asked them before. He began to look as citizens, as customers. And he began to survey those individual people who came into contact with the police department to get their feedback. How was the process? How were you treated? And that even went so far as to send survey documents to people who were in the jails and in the prisons. So he wanted their feedback. Mm-hmm. They were customers of the process. And of course, some of them were irritated about the outcome of the process, but they also got valuable feedback.
That's a really important piece of it. The early contact with the justice system, Lauren, has now become really a hallmark of people's attitudes towards criminal justice. Your first contact and how that went down, even if you came out on the bottom side of it, being treated in a civil, humane, and fair manner within certain parameters is really considered to be sort of frames a lot of whatever comes out.
David Cooper was ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
You know, when I talked about, the curve earlier, he was clearly in the front of that, and he was ahead on the national basis. And he even went so far as he had the National Institute of Justice come into the city to study his organization to give him feedback. And in their report that they issued, they wrote, "Surely the most dramatic finding in this project is that it is possible to bend granite." And it was from that report that we got the name of the book. Because if you think about it, granite is hard, but it is possible. And when the Law Enforcement Institute came in and studied it, they said David Cooper has proved that it is possible to bend granite. And that's where we got the name of the book.
And I think another couple things that to build on that. One is David, as Michael mentioned, really built a cadre of leaders within the department. I mean, he built some people who are still police chiefs in other parts of the country now because they were in that mix of culture and other communities that were more progressive saw them as people they wanted to have in their towns as their police chief. He also got people out of their cars and started community policing way before. And I went out with some of those early officers and was teaching them how to be a community organizer, how to do one-on-one relationship building with people.
I have a friend who's a retired cop, and sort of one of the hallmarks of her career was that she suggested to Cooper that they ride bikes.
Amen.
And people thought that was a crazy idea, and he got her a bike, and she was a State Street cop, and just rode up and down that area on her bike, and of course, see lots of cops on bikes now here and all across the country. But it was really a life-changing contribution for for her and made a difference in the city from here on in. She, I mean, among other things, he also integrated the police department both by gender and race,
which
was a huge undertaking.
It was, and it resulted in Madison, I don't know about the situation now, but I probably still is the highest number of women officers in the country. And it just makes us feel good to know that that we were one of the first in making that happen.
Time is to say that you've been listening, get caught up in this conversation for those of you who have been listening and wondering what are these guys, who are these people and what are they talking about? You've been listening to Madison Bookbeat. I guess the sun is waning in light at this point. And we have with us the authors and compilers of a book on quality improvement called Bending Granite, 30 plus true stories of leading change. And we're talking about, and this is Mike Williamson and Tom Moskaller, who both are long-term, I guess, change agents here in the Madison community and around the country. And the book is really many interesting issues of all different kinds of institutions and organizations that I'm sure you as a listener have interacted with. We just finished talking about the Madison Police Department, but many others, hospitals, the Madison School District, and as well as other ones. And there's one that's for Reynolds Moving and Transfer. So how does that work? What happened there? If you could just summarize that as sort of a much different kind of situation.
Well, Jake Reynolds, who is, like fourth generation, I think, within that. I mean, they've been around a long time. Mm-hmm. He really picked it up. The culture was there for this, but when this kind of approach of using a clear sense of purpose, having a solid process and how you treat your people was put into a framework, Jake is a young leader, and he picked this up and has applied it in all kinds of ways within improving the processes for moving businesses. And they've continued to expand and grow. And that's been a result of the work that he's helped infuse in the culture.
What's the thing that, give an example of what's the thing that he,
getting frontline people to have a sense that they can make change. So if you're out there moving something, you're being encouraged to share ideas and possibilities. And, he and his leadership is taking that and giving people the chance to actually pilot test different things they can be doing to improve the process of moving, right?
Yeah.
Of which there's all kinds of steps in that kind of system.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of this work came out of manufacturing because that's where it came out of the Toyotas and the Hondas. And the thing that we were able to do is translate that for a broader audience into other kind of not-for-profit world, government, education, healthcare, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing that's different about the Reynolds story and a few others is most of these are government stories or nonprofits. And I guess the rap was initially is that this stuff doesn't work unless you have a profit motive there. And as you said in the beginning, Michael, in terms of the garage, they're just lazy and there's nothing you can do about it or fire them or whatever. And how do you get people to both organizational leaders who don't have the motive of, gee, I'm going to make more money, or workers saying you're going to be paid more if you do this better? What's the driving force then? This sort of belies the motive, that the notion that profit drives monetary reward drives everything.
Well, I think one of the powers of the book is the stories cross all of the range of types of organizations. So whether that be American Family or Playcon on the private sector side, healthcare, education. But particularly in the public sector was the whole question, we don't have customers. They're our constituents, but they're not our customers.
Mm-hmm.
No, we need to look at them as our customers and how can we improve service. So whether that was in tree limb and leaf pickup, whether that was in our planning department, what do the customers want? They want quicker turnaround time. They may not always get, you know, like in the legal system, you may not like the outcome, but how were you treated in the system? What were their needs? And we began to ask those questions. And the nonprofit organizations did the same thing. Tom's got a great story in there about going into a mental health area and checking in and how he was treated with doing just a survey. This was one of those exploratory, go in and act like you've got a client that needs help. How are they treated? And the people who ran the organization had no idea that people were treated that way. And they were able to transform that process.
Well, if a leader says, well, I'm a department head of leaf pickup, I don't care really, man. I mean, we're doing okay. We pick up a lot of leaves. And if I do this or don't do this, I'm not going to make any more money. Leaves will still sort of get picked up the way they've always been. And see you later. You
know? To me, that's kind of a callous view of the human condition. I really think that intrinsic motivation, right, coming from the heart, the habit of the heart, is so critical. And you know, if you have that kind of mindset about, let's say, city employees or at your hospital, then mm-hmm. you're going to build a culture like that mm-hmm. where it's extrinsically motivated. You gotta create incentives. You gotta, right? And we found out in all of the departments we work with at the city, my work at the engineering school, and the list goes on. People want to do great work.
Mm-hmm. They want to be part of something, too.
They want to be proud of it. They want to mm-hmm. own it. They want mm-hmm. to feel like they actually made a difference. Mm-hmm. And what I've thought about this a lot. What we really did was to free people up who oftentimes didn't get a chance to actually, they see everything every day that could be improved, but they don't have a way to do that. And we gave them permission mm-hmm. and a process
yeah.
that was legitimate
yeah.
and mm-hmm. data-driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think Deming's statement that you said that everybody wants joy. I mean, that may be a bit of a reach, but everybody does want to feel good about it and not feel like, you know, another day of toil and sorrow. But I'm part of the organization and I know what the goals are and this is my piece of the action here.
Yeah.
Well, and if you go back and you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, it's number one is I got to feed myself. I've got to provide shelter. I need a job. I need money. But those lose their luster in terms of creating quality of life and happiness. And what really comes down to, am I making a difference? Am I contributing? And once we were able to allow people throughout the organization to contribute to where they could see they were making it. They weren't just doing their job and drawing a check. But that's where leadership comes into the equation, is you have to have leaders who can actually help change that culture. And I think we were able to do that, and the people who were reporting in this book were able to do that in organizations across the city.
Tell me about stories where it didn't work out.
Well, you know, if this was a TV show, we could show you the scar tissue where we've been drugged, you know, behind. But there are stories where things don't work out, but it usually comes down to leadership, to where the leadership didn't create the right culture. But
the culture of change,
culture of change mm-hmm. and reinforcing that, recognizing that and acknowledging that you have to recognize people when they are, you know, when they're making good things, when they're making change happen, and it's a new system, because the tendency is to go back and do things the way we've always done them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as reading the book, I reflected on a state agency. The agency is incapable of learning. And they, you know, it's an agency, like many state agencies, just had lots of contracts with, you know, tons of organizations, and they would get reports and check off that they got the report and file it, and nothing ever happened. They never sort of absorbed what people were telling them, and they were always at this 5 or 10 year delay, and this is a health organization, in doing it. And part of what you're doing and sort of the long-term effect is that it becomes a learning organization. So it's not just the thing that happens then and that people learn, but on a continuing basis of this is what a learning process is for our organization. This is how we can stay in the moment and continue to improve or continue to help our customers who may be changing and want different things.
So a story is going through my head, David, that is current about, about 5 years ago, I was working, because I farm on the side, I was working with the fact that we're having a lot of suicides among farmers and a lot of people stressed out in rural areas. And so we, the police chiefs in Southwest Wisconsin, plus human service people and school counselors, all the people that were kind of in the process of helping take care of people's health in a rural area and rural communities, got together and we looked at, why is this happening? And the only thing we had going for us was when somebody had a breakdown or was stressed out, we'd haul them to Winnebago in the back of a police car, right? I mean, and what we learned from that, from customer feedback, was I'll never declare myself having a mental stress problem. I'll just figure out another way to deal with it because I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah.
And they pass that around and you just suppress people's need to get their mental health taken care of. So what we did was a walkthrough where we took one of the, I think one of the more courageous conservative legislators who's a farmer out there, and we put him through the process of actually being put in the back of a police car on his farm, going through the protocol, getting hauled to the local hospital, seeing what it was like to have to go through 3 hours of treatment at the hospital where all he's saying is, who's going to milk my cows tonight, right?
Yes.
And then they load him back in the car and haul him to Winnebago. My goodness, you know, finally, this week, I just saw in the paper, and this is the point I want to make, you got to be patient with this stuff. Legislation was approved to set up respite care facilities in parts of the state so we don't have to haul people to Winnebago when they just need a chance to get away from the situation that causes that anxiety and stress in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a small victory.
Yeah.
But you got to have some patience to allow that process to happen.
So it was the legislator that learned, and it was a common process among all these different agencies that didn't talk to each other.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and boy, we see that. Michael and I saw that, and we see that all of our lives doing this work is so many of the processes are not within just a department. They cross between departments, between agencies, between the public school system and the city government and the healthcare system. Those processes are all over the place. And so getting people together across those systems to trust each other and learn together is critical.
One of the cases is the, I forget his name, the change agent at UW-Madison. And he described some interventions, some practices that he employed, and some of them are simple, good practices. I mean, this is not, it wasn't rocket science. I mean, one of the things that he did, which was, a huge breakthrough, is he had department chairs talk to each other.
Well, I can give
you were at UW too, right?
Yeah, I worked at UW, and I was actually head of the Office of Quality Improvement there. Yeah. And but there are examples. John Wiley, who went on to, he was head of the graduate school, worked as in the engineering department. But he was a great champion for this, he's got a story in the book. And David Ward is referenced in there as a former chancellor as well. But one of the things that was happening was they would recruit these engineering students. They would bring them in. They would require them to take a math course. They would go take the math course, and the math department was teaching them as if they were going to be PhD
mathematicians.
Right, if they were going to be mathematicians. And a lot of the quality engineering students would drop out.
Yeah.
And so they created this team, and they got the math department to actually talk to the engineering department, and they created a curriculum for the engineering students was what they needed to be engineers, not what they needed to be math PhDs.
Right.
But it's a perfect example of beginning to break that down and getting them to talk to each other. You know, people say, well, this is just common sense. The problem is, yeah, it makes sense. It's just not that common in the world that we live in today and or back then.
Yeah, especially sort of a behemoth like UW. Well,
yeah.
I mean, it's 1,000 different mini corporations or mini enterprises that are, in some cases, quite autonomous to each
and
other.
You want to talk about a challenge? You try to convince faculty members that students are their customers. They're not my customers. They are what I make them to be, you know. But that transformation occurred, and the university still has an Office of Quality Improvement that is working with departments and has got tremendous successes in making them more efficient, but also more customer-oriented.
Yeah. I mean, the math story is, I mean, that then continued, and I know that we had the same problem with people who were pre-med, who then had to take, you know, not upper level, but certainly with the whole calculus series and so on. And they were competing in many cases with students in their classes who were mathematicians. Not only was it irrelevant, but in terms of the curve, they were sort of adversely placed. As you read the book, the number of people, both the authors and the people who were cited as being instrumental in the change area, is the number of women who were leaders of this movement and leaders of this process. A lot of this takes place, you know, 40 years ago, as well as this week. But some of the cases here are old, but still women are instrumental in it. And so you want to talk a bit about why is that? How is it that that came about, that women really were it?
Well, there is considerable research out there that show women actually make better leaders of organizations than men. They're
true.
More sensitive to the environment. Their instincts tend to be better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the adrenaline and the hormones, men get all fired up. So there's a lot of research that show that's the case. Unfortunately, our organizations don't reflect that necessarily. But if you look at who might be most willing and open to accepting these practices and putting this culture change in place, it's women. And mm-hmm. so therefore, that I think it follows, there's a natural connection between women being leaders in this field and in these change-making organizations.
I just would add, you know, whether it was the city or the work at the engineering school or other places I've had the chance, I just want to affirm what Michael said, that women have stepped up. I think it gave them permission to lead, or they could take on something and make a difference. And I know in the city, when we were trying to get this established, the women who came forward in different departments, public health and at the transit system, and you can go on and on, even in the streets department, the women who stepped up and really took point on leading teams and making a difference, because they've been muted for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now they had a chance and a process that gave them a way to do this was a wonderful opportunity for them. And many of them then moved into leadership roles in those departments or other places.
But many of them, other people became leaders and are consultants and change agents for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And they're
for quality. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they sort of normalize the fact of talking about differences without being upset about it and saying that there are problems in the organization and being able to articulate it. And that's sort of one of the things that has to be overcome.
I just got to share a contemporary story of something I'm working on, David. So I'm working on the fact that we lose a third of our first-year teachers in the upper Midwest. So people go through school, their family invests in them, they've got a passion, they go into classrooms, and we lose them in the first year. By the third year, we lose 44%, and if they make it 5 years, many of them will stay in the profession, right? And most of these are women. Teachers, a lot of them are women.
Sure.
And what we've been doing is applying this to how do we help retain these young teachers? This is costing society a lot of money when we lose these young, talented teachers. And we have developed an approach to do that. And so I'm working with almost all women coaches who are mentoring young teachers right now, and they really want to see this happen.
Mm-hmm. And for people to say that there's a problem, and for people not to get uptight and defensive about it. And I think that's one of the things that women may be better at, and that is often a stumbling block. And it's sort of raised a number of times in the healthcare field where, I don't think it's in the book, but I read separately how in surgical operations, there was sort of one way to do it in terms of preparing. And then through quality improvement, people said, well, you could really reduce the number of mistakes made if you have a checklist of things that you should do. And they adopted that from airline pilots, where they read it. And now that's sort of standard practice now in operating rooms to say.
Yeah, and there's a really good book out there called Checklist Gawanda. And it's about exactly what you're talking about for people who are looking for reference on that kind of way to use process improvement and get away from who reports to who and how does the system work horizontally as opposed to hierarchically.
That's it for this conversation. We've been listening to Madison Bookbeat, a weekly show highlighting local authors and authors coming to town. We've been speaking with Tom Mossgaller and Michael Williamson and their new book, Bending Granite, 30 True Stories of Leading Change. I've been your host, David Ahrens. Stay tuned for 3 hours of jazz on All Around Jazz with Alex Wilding White. But first, the Insurgent Radio Kiosk. You've been listening to Community Radio, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 8th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions, this week in music history for April 8th. On April 8th, 1994, The Offspring's third album, Smash, was released. Smash is in contention for the best-selling indie release of all time, and for good reason. Its sound was tempered just enough to suit the masses, while the energy and themes resonated with the kids at the time. After its heyday in the 70s and early 80s, punk's popularity faded, giving rise to subgenres like ska punk, hardcore, and grunge. Grunge in particular took off with Nirvana's Nevermind in 1991. Oddly enough, Kurt Cobain was found dead on April 8, 1994, the same day Smash was released. The thirsty earholes of the masses were obviously not satisfied with wallowing in the self-doubt, abuse, neglect, and betrayal so prominent in many of the grungy songs, and welcomed the poignant lessons and energetic sound of punk back. Arguments rage whether The Offspring were punk enough, but the fact remains that in spite of there being a large number of other West Coast punk bands, they, along with Green Day, were the first introduction many kids had to punk. Whether it's true punk or not, Smash was part of the foundation of the bridge that brought punk to millions of kids. It's 30 years later, and I feel like if it were released today, it would do the same thing. Also this week, April 8th, 1974, Aerosmith releases Toys in the Attic, featuring the tracks Sweet Emotion and Walk This Way. April 8th, 1977, The Clash released their self-titled debut album. That was this week, years ago. Punk is defined by an attitude rather than a musical style.
State Senator Melissa Agard and State Representative Samba Balde invite you to a listening session today from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Let them know what you're thinking. They'll meet in the fireplace room at Lakeview Library.